The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Douglas presiding.
Please be seated. First case on calendar is Pacific Care of Nevada versus Rogers. Before we get into argument, we have a...
Yeah, I would like to disclose that my husband's law firm, Morris Peterson, entered an appearance on behalf of Bedford Labs in an unrelated case to this one. It does not affect how I approach it or give rise to actual or apparent bias, but nonetheless, I want to disclose that for the record because I did recuse on another case in which Bedford had actually been a party to the underlying proceeding.
Either counsel wishes to make any representation, please do so now. If not, please state your name and come to argument if you wish to reserve any time.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Larry Scarborough, and along with Connie Ackridge and Alex Grimsley, I represent Pacific Air. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal if I could. Pacific Air operates multiple lines of business in Nevada. Some are regulated by state law, others by federal law, depending upon the line of business and the nature of the legal claims that have been brought against it. In this case, there's no dispute that we're talking about the line of business that relates to federal Medicare benefits. A Medicare enrollee, like Ms. Rogers in this case, has a couple of options in terms of receiving her Medicare benefits, and those options arise every single year by operation of federal law, as this court has seen in a prior case. One option is to accept federal Medicare benefits directly from the federal government. That is, the federal government pays the doctors, the providers directly, or an enrollee like Ms. Rogers can opt for what's commonly referred to as Part C, which is to receive federal Medicare benefits from an entity like Pacific Care, call it an HMO or a managed care organization. At last web search, there were 32 such organizations offering Medicare Advantage plans in the greater Las Vegas area. For its part, Pacific Air contracts with the federal agency that oversees Medicare, that would be the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, on an annual basis, and has a product that it offered for use in Nevada called Secure Horizons, which is a program for which Ms. Rogers enrolled and had her Medicare benefits received and provided in that way in 2007, which is the year in which she received the procedure at the Endoscopy Center of Southern Nevada, out of which this claim and many other claims have arisen over the last few years. Now, due to the nature of the Medicare contract, each year Pacific Care provides beneficiaries with what's called an evidence of coverage. It's a lot of terminology and jargon commonly referred to as an EOC. And that contains the terms and the conditions under which those benefits are provided in the particular calendar year. With dispositive effect, we contend in the circumstances of this case that annual evidence of coverage falls under the rubric of marketing materials under the Code of Federal Regulations, and that EOC, which contains the arbitration provision in this case, must be put to CMS for review and approval before it can ever be offered to an enrollee like Ms. Rogers. And once it's offered, Pacific Air has to take all comers as long as the beneficiary meets the enrollment criteria. So what we have is a dispute resolution process in that federally approved evidence of coverage that clearly applies to the disputes in this case, because there can't...
Well, Mr. Scarborough, that may be true for the 2007 policy, but there are no arbitration provisions in 2008. Should the district court have resolved under which year this dispute actually applies before conducting an analysis of the policy and whether arbitration should be ordered?
The district court entered a very conclusionary order, but the force and content of that order make it clear that it did make a decision as to which contract applied, because as the court points out, there's an arbitration provision in 2007, there's none in 2008. If it hadn't concluded that the 2007 provision applied, there would have been no need to go on. Of course, we think it should not have done it, but to go on and examine it under conscionability standards under Nevada law.
Where in the order does the court identify which year this claim falls in? I don't see that.
As I said, it doesn't say. It's a conclusion.
We're assuming that just because the court reached that issue.
I think the...
Why shouldn't this court remand the case back to the district court and require the district court to decide in which year this claim arises before deciding whether arbitration is required under the 2007 coverage?
Several answers to that, Your Honor. The arbitration provision isn't written in terms of when the claim arises. It is written in terms of what kind of disputes there are. As I said, the law
under the Medicare Act itself, the provisions of the 2007 contract terminate at the end of the year.
Right, and as we've briefed, they have to survive, just like a labor agreement would survive, determination to govern the dispute, because there's no question that, and we've touched on this previously about 16 months ago in the Griffiths case, Your Honor, where if there were no contract in 2007 when she received that procedure at the endoscopy center, there'd be no claim at all. We would have been able, I believe, successfully to dismiss the entirety of the claim, because in the 2008 contract governs benefits in 2008. So if she were treated as she was, according to the allegations of the complaint, in 2007, it has to be the 2007 EOC that governs the dispute resolution. And as I said, despite the conclusionary order that the court below entered, the reality is that there would have been no need to examine the agreement for conscionability if the 2008 agreement had been held to apply. So, definitionally, the 2007 agreement was the agreement that the court looked at in coming to the conclusion that the arbitration provision in that agreement was unconscionable. So I think, in a classic Ron Voss sort of way, if a remand order goes back to the court, there's going to be an immediate determination that it's the 2007 agreement that that court held to be unconscionable. Again, there's no provision, arbitration provision in 2008, and we'll be back here on the same issue. From our perspective, that logic is sound, and there is no chance that the 2008 agreement was applied to this particular case. So the important takeaway as we move into preemption is that the EOC constitutes marketing materials. Contrary to what Ms. Rogers says, those marketing material regulations that CMS uses to review go straight to the procedure and the substance of the grievance procedure contained in that evidence of coverage when it talks about the kind of positioning of any provisions and, in substance, the meaningfulness of the grievance resolution process. So in doing that, it walks right into the Medicare preemption statute. This court knows that it was changed substantially in 2003, and it was changed with a couple of key effects. One was that there are only two exceptions related to the preemption statute. One relates to solvency and licensing laws. No one contends on this appeal that those have anything to do here. And the second important takeaway is that the inquiry is whether there are federal standards that would relate to the underlying basis of the cause of action that's being asserted. Where federal standards exist, state law gives way. And as I just said, because the federal standards apply to the content of the evidence of coverage, both from a procedural perspective and a substantive perspective, state law unconscionability analysis gives way, and those materials have preemptive sweep, and the arbitration provision ought to be upheld. Now, it's not only the logic of the standards and the regulations that suggest that. The court, since the last time we were here talking about arbitration, has seen that the Ninth Circuit has come forward with its decision in which clarifies that these marketing material standards do count for preemptive effect. And because they do count for preemptive effect, preemption here absolutely attaches. Before I sit down,
I have another question for you. On JA-265 of the record, it recites the fact that arbitration is to occur in accordance with comprehensive rules and procedures of JAMS. And then on JA-266, page 78 of the agreement, it provides that the arbitration proceedings shall be governed by the Federal Arbitration Act, which apply.
Well, both apply. The Federal Arbitration Act lives in harmony with the Medicare Act. That is the, those are the controlling federal statutes, and the parties have agreed by contract that when it comes to the procedure that's going to govern the actual arbitration, that the JAMS rules apply. As the court knows, the Federal Arbitration Act, in its simplicity, doesn't go on to provide a series of, say, discovery-related or trial-related rules. It leaves that to the parties who typically choose the AAA or JAMS or whichever entity in order to do that. Because I would like to reserve my time, unless there are questions, I'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
Mr. Sharp.
May it please the court, on behalf of Dorothy Rogers, I'd like to address three points that I think necessitate a requirement of finding and upholding the district court's opinion. First, I would say the whole argument about Medicare preemption is something this court need not address because the arbitration clause specifically incorporates the provisions to the Federal Arbitration Act, and that was just pointed out at JA-266. Secondly, I would say if the court decides to substantively address the Medicare preemption, that there's two reasons there's no Medicare preemption. And the first, there's no federal standard pertaining to unconscionability. And secondly, the standards for unconscionability in the state of Nevada is not something with respect to an MA plan, so it's not subject to the express terms of the MMA preemption. And the third point I would make is, on its face, this contract is clearly unconscionable both procedurally and substantively. So with that, I'll begin with the Medicare preemption issue.
Could you talk about, Mr. Sharp, about the Hume versus Humana case, again, for the record, 620 F3rd 1134, and how that implicates your particular argument, then?
I will do that, Justice Gibbons. The first point I would like to make is preemption applies to state laws, not federal laws. And clearly, whatever was approved, and I would point out, this court has no record of what exactly was approved, the approval process. None of that was provided by Pacific Care to the court below. But what we do know is that the specific provision that was approved by CMS included reference to the Federal Arbitration Act. So I think it lacks logic that the idea would be that a federal law would preempt another federal law. Secondly, the first rule of preemption is you look at the plain language to the statute and thereafter determine congressional intent and determine if this act is somehow inconsistent with congressional intent. And the first thing I would point out is Medicare is basically an insurance program. There is a specific provision within the federal law that limits the federal government's involvement and specifically does not allow the federal government to be involved in issues pertaining to quality of care. This case pertains only to quality of care. What Ms. Rogers is alleging is that because of the negligence of PacifiCare, she went to an unsafe medical provider and contracted hepatitis C. There's no question about Medicare benefits, nothing involved in that regard. So with those two points in mind, the statute specifically says the standards established under this part shall supersede any state law or regulation with respect to MA plans which are offered by MA organizations. And the first thing that I'd like to point out is that when you're analyzing that statute, there's a difference under the law, and you can find this at 42 CFR 422.2. There's a distinction between an MA organization and an MA plan. The statute only applies to laws or regulations with respect to the MA plan, not the MA organization. Now, what we were dealing with in UM was a specific allegation that material that was approved by CMS was essentially fraudulent. And what the court found in UM was two points. As to the deceptive, there were two common law claims brought. As to the deceptive claims practice, the court found that it required a showing that materials deemed by CMS were misleading when CMS had already found they weren't misleading. So there was an express conflict there. Now, we know with unconscionability, you don't have to prove that something's misleading. You have to prove that it may be, you know, procedurally unconscionable in the sense, like in this case, that you've got at page 76 of a 100-page document, you've got an arbitration provision, part of which is in bold print here, but all of the substantive provisions, you know, including limitations on rights, limitations on statute of limitations, are in small print. As to the substantive unconscionability, you don't have to necessarily show that there was fraud or that it was misleading. You have to show it was one-sided. And in this particular case, I think if you look at the entirety of the provision, one, you have a statute of limitation of 1 year from the date of the event, whatever that means. You have a limitation in remedies, no special damages, no indirect damages, whatever that means, no punitive damages. And I want to point out to you that when you look at this arbitration clause, this has nothing to do with benefits payable under the contract. That's all subject to the Medicare appeals process. So basically, this arbitration clause is designed to incorporate cases just like this where you have personal injury. And where you have personal injury and potential issues, already no special damages. Punitive damages. Well, we know who that is intended to assist. That's intended to assist PacifiCare. Statute of limitations, same issue. We even have a class prohibition, and on top of that, you also have within the provision itself a choice of law provision pertaining to Delaware. Has no correlation to the parties in this case, yet I would suspect that Delaware law is more favorable than Nevada law. And on top of that, you have the JAMS procedure, which we all know notoriously JAMS is more expensive. We have, in addition to that, the confidentiality provision, which I would submit is intended to assist PacifiCare. All of those things looking together, they may not be misleading, clearly one-sided, clearly intended to prohibit people from asserting their rights. Now, the defense will come up and say, or PacifiCare might come up and say, well, that each individual provision, we can find a case that says it's okay to select a form or it's okay to limit punitive damages. I would submit that you can't find a case that limits all of these things. in the way that Pacific Air does, particularly in relation to a personal injury claim. And I think the Engle case from the Ninth Circuit points that out, and that was in a consumer fraud type case, and there were similar provisions here, and it was declared unconscionable. But back to the Boone case, so when you look at the Boone case as to the deceptive trade practice, clearly there's not an overlap. The fraud claim was similar in that what basically the Ninth Circuit said is that a fraud finding would directly undermine CMS's prior determination that it was not misleading. So again, back to the same point, we don't have to prove it was necessarily the clause was misleading. And on top of that, I would point the court out to footnote 35 of the court's opinion in Oom, where it said specifically, not all fraud in the inducement claims are preempted. It was that particular claim was preempted because you need to look at the facts and not put on a label on it. And if you look at the facts underlying Oom, I think the primary thing you see with Oom is essentially what the case was about was a claim for benefit. What the allegation was is that there was basically a misleading practice that people were signed up, premium was taken, and then the benefit was not provided. But if you, and the dissent's opinion kind of, the concurring opinion and kind of addresses this point, that really at base, it was a benefit case. Benefits payable, you know, whether a benefit is payable is directly within CMS's authority. Common law claim in Oom would run counter to that intent. Here, you have a personal injury case that CMS admittedly has no interest in, and so there's nothing that would undermine Congress's authority. And with that, I'd like to point to the court from the Federal Register, 70 Federal Register 4665, and this was part of the CMS enactment of the preemption provision. CMS came up with certain, I guess you would call them rules or guidance within the Federal Register. And initially what CMS had taken the position is that any type of common law-oriented claim for negligence, personal injury, contract would survive preemption. And there were some complaints along those lines that claims specific to the MA plan, even if posed in the common law, i.e. like Oom, should be preempted, and CMS agreed. But within CMS's statement, they said, in response to this comment, we would clarify that all standards, including those established through case law, are preempted to the extent they specifically regulate the MA plan. Other state and health safety standards or generally applicable standards that do not involve regulation of an MA plan are not preempted. And we know from prior Supreme Court cases, I think it's the rental car case, that generally arbitration agreements are considered to be a separate agreement from the plan itself. So really what we have is an arbitration agreement between PacifiCare, the MA organization, and Mrs. Rogers as the enrollee, and the question is whether that's enforceable.
So is your point that under the preemption clause, the 42 U.S.C. 1395W, that the standards under this part superseding state law, that language doesn't encompass the approval of plan literature that has an arbitration clause provided in it, that's entirely separate?
I would agree with that, and to further substantiate my point would be the fact that the FAA is incorporated within the provisions of the contract. So it's hard for me to believe that CMS had an intent or Congress had an intent to preempt the law they explicitly referred to in the approved contract.
Then could you comment on their argument that the CMS approval of the marketing literature is in and of itself an approval of the arbitration clause, no matter how draconian that clause might be?
Well, I think that when there's temperament in that analysis, I don't think there's anything in the congressional record that said CMS approval meant precluding a litigant from asserting a due process right, number one, or precluding a court from interpreting an insurance contract. Nothing within the record. And in our brief, we analyzed to, you know, the approval process for insurance contracts. The second point I would make, and I think is important, is the defense refers to the grievance process in their brief, in their reply brief. And the grievance process is separate and apart from arbitration, and the grievance process is not arbitration. The two are not the same. In the reply brief, it is inferred, if not explicitly stated, and effectively they're the same. And I would point to the court, 42 CFR 422.564, which is the section dealing with grievance. And, for example, its grievance is MA organization must have a procedure to resolve a dispute between Mrs. Rogers and PacifiCare, not a third party resolving that dispute. The dispute must be filed within 60 days after the event. Response must be within 30 days. So it's clearly separate from arbitration. And within that, I just apologize because I was looking for the site, but there, within that process, there's nothing within the grievance process that, within the federal regulations, that talks about the enforceability standards for unconscionable or arbitration. Does it have to be one-sided? Does it have to take into account procedural fairness and substantive fairness? That's not within the code of federal regulations. So I think this is a matter that's clearly outside CMS's expertise.
Mr. Sharp, Justice Hardesty asked a question earlier to the other side as to the 207, 208, 208 contract years. What is your position as to that?
Well, I think that that's, my position is that the 2008 would apply because explicitly under the terms of the contract, the arbitration agreement says any and all disputes. There was no dispute in 2007 by its terms. The 2007 arbitration agreement stopped, and a new policy was issued in 2008.
So, Mr. Sharp, why did Judge Williams address the unconscionability issue then?
My opinion, Your Honor, would be that it's such a simple issue. I mean, it's...
Go ahead and conclude.
It's so clearly unconscionable. I mean, when you read the text of this provision, it's so clearly unconscionable. You don't need to really get into the nuances of MMA preemption because the provision within the contract refers to federal arbitration. But if you get into that MMA preemption analysis, clearly CMS, Congress did not intend for their authority to preclude people from raising questions about substantive and procedural unconscionability.
Well, Mr. Sharp, that might be the case before AT&T's decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. I wonder if you could comment on that decision and its impact on state law unconscionability determination. I assume you would concede that the contract in 2007 is governed by the FAA. If that's the case, why doesn't AT&T Mobility preclude any unconscionability determination in those kinds of agreements?
Well, I would point out first, Your Honor, and I'm glad you brought the Concepcion case up because I'd forgotten to address it. First, I'd like to point out that basically what Justice Scalia wrote the majority opinion. I mean, the ruling really is specific just to the Discovery Banks rule that you have to have opportunity for class-wide arbitration within an arbitration agreement. And I say that because really the nexus of the criticism from the court was that the California standard was specific to arbitration only. I mean, so this particular contract, a particular rule, really only applied to arbitration cases. And what the court said is you have to apply general contract law to an arbitration agreement. It didn't say that general contract law was preempted. It just said whatever standard you apply applies to all types of contracts, which I would submit our case law and procedural and substantive unconscionability is applicable really to any type of contract you're analyzing. And with that, I would go back again to the 70 Federal Register 4665, which says generally applicable standards survive preemption. So for those two reasons, I would say the Concepcion case really has no application here, and whatever it does have is very minor. And with that, if the court has no further questions, I will
see. Any additional questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. I'm going to move forward quickly because there are a number of things that need to be straightened out. On the dispute arising in 2008, I want to point out there was no dispute that arose in 2008 either. The complaint in this action, the dispute, wasn't commenced until 2009. So the agreement, I think comfortably it can be concluded, that was reviewed by the court below was the 2007 agreement. Next, Mr. Sharp says that the arbitration provision is not within the grievance compartment of the EOC. The table of contents dispels that, the section title dispels that, and he gave you a cite to 422.564. Let's back up to 561, which is definitional. There are only two kinds of disputes in this Medicare world, according to the federal regulations. One is an organizational determination, and the other one is everything else. Organizational determinations deal with benefits, and then there's everything else. This is an everything else, and I cite 422.561 for the court to be able to confirm that on its own. Next, there's a discussion that certainly CMS did not approve either the procedure or the substance of the EOC in terms of providing an adequate grievance. First, we're dealing with a federal benefit. The federal government clearly has exclusive province of determining what's meaningful. That's why we're here on a preemption argument. And if you take a look at 422.2260, 2262, 2264, you will see the ways in which CMS looks to determine and did determine in this case that the EOC was compliant or else PacifiCare could not have offered it to the general public. Now, importantly, whether the back and forth between CMS and PacifiCare exists or doesn't exist is irrelevant to this inquiry as a matter of law because of the way Congress chose to phrase preemption. The test for any court is whether there are standards. So if there are standards within the CFR that would cover what's being argued, namely the validity of this arbitration provision, then preemption attaches.
Well, where are those standards that govern the validity of this arbitration provision?
They are within the ambit of the grievance procedure, which contains the arbitration provision in the statutes that I just read off to the court, and in an additional one, which is 560, where CMS is required to determine that in total, that the grievance procedure is meaningful for recipients of Medicare. That's the substantive component of the two items. And specifically, so that the court can find it, it's 422.560 sub A sub 1. That's where CMS must determine whether the grievance procedures are meaningful. Coming to UM. UM says that in a fraud context, that the marketing materials that are deemed to be sufficient can't be deemed to be misleading. So to here, the grievance procedure that's deemed meaningful and adequate cannot be deemed by a court to be unconscionable, monstrously harsh, etc. That's why the UM case, analytically speaking, takes care of and confirms the analysis that we have offered to the court. With respect to that legislative history that Mr. Sharp read you at page 4665, I refer you to the UM case itself, which puts that in the context of the totality of all the regulations and the legislative history, to say that, of course, we're not talking about labels or claims. We're talking about federal standards. And whereas the standards control and approve the content of the EEOC, it is simply not open for a court to declare it unconscionable based on state law.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have one more point I'd like to address if I could, but I know I'm over.
You're over, counsel.
Okay. I've actually got one question. I'd like to have you address Mr. Sharpe's view of the AT&T mobility case versus concession.
Certainly. The AT&T case is brand new law. It deals with two things that are very important to plaintiffs' challenge to the arbitration provision, and that has to do with the class-wide determination and also with confidentiality, by the way. AT&T says that a class-wide prohibition on arbitration is not, because of the Federal Arbitration Act, defeating of an arbitration provision. It also says that confidentiality in arbitration, in the vernacular, is perfectly fine. So that case does take care of two of their several challenges there. The important thing about AT&T as it relates here is we don't have the kind of clause that says no class arbitration, no how, no way. It simply says no arbitration class claims. If you're going to have a class claim, go to court. And the final point, which should be a big takeaway for this court, is we're not dealing with the kind of claims as in Picardi, which this court recently decided, where we're talking about aggregating claims that might never be brought. For goodness sake, in the endoscopy center cases, there have been a multitude of cases filed by individual plaintiffs, sometimes against multiple defendants in different cases. There's no underlying concern that claims need to be aggregated or else justice is not likely to be done. And so that also doesn't apply. I hope I answered the court's question.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The court appreciates the arguments that were offered this morning. They were very informational and educational for us to look at our decision. With that, thank you. It's submitted. Next case on calendar is State versus Worth.